Today on Pilot's Discretion, we're joined by aviation career mentors Mike Martin and Sean Ritchie. They tell us about the latest trends in pilot hiring, the differences between airline and charter flying, and what makes a good co-pilot. Pilot's Discretion starts right now. Welcome, everyone. I'm John Zimmerman, and thanks for listening to Pilot's Discretion from Sporties. You can catch up on previous episodes and find today's show links at sporties.com/podcast, and you can send us an email with your comments or guest ideas at podcast@sporties.com. Today, we have two guests on the show. Mike Martin and Sean Ritchie are both flight instructors and professional pilots with many thousands of hours of experience in both the airline and charter worlds. But in addition to their flying jobs, Mike and Sean are also co-founders of Pro Pilot Playbook, a podcast and mentoring service that helps new pilots pursue a career in aviation. Mike was even brave enough to be my flight instructor about 25 years ago when I got my commercial certificate. Guys, welcome to Pilot's Discretion.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Thanks, Sean. Yeah.
Let's start with an overview of the airline pilot job market right now, because it feels like we're a little bit of an inflection point. There was a red hot 2021 and 22. It seems like things started to cool a little bit last year and then early this year. There's even some scary headlines out there right now about airlines pausing their hiring. So is this a temporary speed bump, or do you think we're at the start of a new phase?
Yeah, well, I guess I'll start. And I think Mike has some things to say on this too, but you know, I think you nailed it with the I like the temporary speed bump thing. You know, and a lot of this, John, to me is, Mike and I have said this before on our show, that it's almost a little bit comical to us that the whole aspect of, you know, some of the stuff on social media, the sky is falling, it's all over, I should just quit training right now. It's just kind of ridiculous. To me anyway. And I think people need to really realize that there's a difference between the hiring surge that we had and the true pilot shortage that's going on in the background. There is, the data indicates it's 100% black and white, you know, that there is a pilot shortage that is going to continue into the 2030s. And there's a lot of things that are being done right now to try to thwart this off. You got Airbus just coming out with that, you know, one of the largest freighters ever built that is certified single pilot. You have the stuff on the Congress floor right now to increase the retirement age to 67, to 65, which is something I predicted 5 years ago that that's what they'll do. They'll match the, you know, the IRS 401k draw thing, like 67 and a half or something. I said that 5 years ago, and now it's actually on the floor to increase it again. So there is absolutely a shortage. And I think what we're seeing right now is a mix of the surge being over, the post-COVID hiring surge coming to an end, and, you know, Boeing just, you know, having trouble, you know, they keep tripping over their own feet here. And
yeah, that's a story that maybe isn't getting told enough for obvious reasons. But I know some of the airlines, including Southwest, have mostly blamed their hiring pauses on just lack of airplanes. And Boeing's production of 737 Maxes right now is just crashed down, no pun intended there. And that's as much a limitation as some other things. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. Totally, yeah. I don't think people realize how many pilots you need per airplane. You know, it's a good number of people.
It's I think 20 something pilots per every airliner to staff it correctly. Yeah.
Yeah. So when you got orders for 25 airplanes you don't have on your ramp and the hiring department was already planning on hiring this many people. Yeah. So
if
somebody hits the pause button, that doesn't mean that that everything is stopped. We don't need any more pilots. This is just like you said, a speed bump, a little.
Yeah, totally, totally. And John, I'm glad you brought this up. And this is a great first question because, you know, we get this constantly. We're getting emails. Fortunately, we've got a nice following on the internet now. And really, it's almost every hour we get an email from somebody. And at least three or four a day about, hey, I'm thinking of jumping into flying now. I've been watching your videos, and because that's what we're all about, encouraging people to get into professional flying. And we just don't know. We've been watching these headlines and just don't know. And to touch on what Sean said, the comical portion of it really is, and how I usually answer this question is. Well, first of all, there was a large Boeing study that you guys can Google, anyone listening to this podcast and Google, that outlines the outlook for the next 10 to 20 years for pilots, and it's staggering numbers needed. And yes, they could go up and down based on certain tweaking of the economy and things like that. But I mean, there's a huge need, and that's a very, very professional study, in my opinion. There's another great video on the internet. We have a partner that we, it's just a friend of ours, another podcaster flying with Trent that does the same type of mission that we do. He's a career 2.0 guy. He has a pilot shortage video that's just phenomenal. He put out a couple weeks ago that really breaks down these reports and where things are going and the Boeing shortage and everything. So I'd encourage everybody to look at that too. But bottom line is, when Sean and I started, so we both are the same age. We actually started at a charter operator, a large jet charter operator, and we were hired on the same day. And we had crossed paths before that, but we both really started our jet careers on the same day. So we started flying in the mid-90s and got in at the beginning of 2000 into flying jets. And there's a point to what I'm saying, but the market was so bad then. I mean, mm-hmm. It was absolutely almost impossible to get a job flying a jet. And I'm not saying this, there's a point to what I'm saying. I'm not saying this to say, oh, it was uphills both ways, walking to school and everything. Nobody wants to hear that, but you'll see where I'm going with this. So when I first got my CFI, you know, I went through Sporty's excellent program. This is in the late 90s. Hardly anyone was hiring, and everybody wanted to work at Comair. Comair was a wholly owned subsidiary of Delta Airlines, and they were the largest operator of Canadair regional jets in the country. And they were the premier kind of entry level jet job at that time. It was so hard to get on there. Their preferred hiring minimums were 3,000 to 5,000 hours, and they wanted hundreds of hours of multi time to get on there. Mm-hmm. And get this, John. Even if you got hired, if you were lucky enough to get hired, you knew somebody, you interviewed well, you scratched and clawed to get this experience, your starting pay was in the low 20s, I think 23 or 24,000.
Yep.
And get this, they had the pilot pay for their airline training. That Comair did. It was $18,500. Okay. Yeah. And this is 25 years ago, right? So your first year you made like 22,000, you had to pay 18 back to them for your training. And this was going on not just at Comair, other airlines were, you know, charging the crews for their hotel rooms and everything because everybody wanted these jobs. It was the exact polar opposite of what's occurring now. And yep. But here's the key reason why I bring this up. John and I both came up during that time period and we were making the decision that your viewers are making right now. A lot of them saying, you're trying to collect as much information and should I jump in? Is this 100% I'm going to get the job? And we said, heck with it. We're going to do it anyway. We're going to spend all this money. And it wasn't that much cheaper than to become a pilot. When you adjust what it costs, for inflation and everything, it was still very expensive then. And there was like the dream of even flying for Delta Airlines or something was so far away. I mean, you couldn't even get on at a regional. We jumped in, both of us, two different backgrounds, jump into it, start our career. We scraped, clawed, and got to where we are today. And neither one of us, I'll let Sean speak on this too, but would trade it for the world. It was an excellent, yes, we're going to make less money than what a pilot would have started today, but every job that I had, every stepping stone, it was just a wonderful career. And this was in the worst conditions ever possible for a pilot really to come up through. So we had all that hiring in the late 90s, or all that hard, that everything I just spoke of was in the late 90s. Then September 11th happened in 2001. Which made the public scared to fly on any airplanes. I mean, that's when I started doing different jobs. I became a real estate agent, all that kind of stuff. Then you had the 2008 financial crisis on top of all of that. I mean, someone watching this video, I'm never going to say never, but I don't think they could ever repeat the economic conditions that Sean and I endured through our career. And still, in retrospect, here's two guys looking back at this, wouldn't trade it for the world. So to think when a guy sends me an email and says, Mike, I can't get hired before I even pass my CFI check ride for an airline with a conditional job offer that's going to pay me a stipend of $1,000 a month and $100,000 signing bonus. Do you think it's a good time to be a pilot?
Right.
Kind of makes me laugh.
Exactly. And Mike, I know exactly what you're talking about with that Com Air interview. I interviewed there and simultaneously was interviewing for ASA in Atlanta, which was the other wholly owned company by Delta at the time. And it was a 2-day long interview. There were 20 jobs for the 100 guys there to interview, and they were looking for perfect human specimens. There was written tests, computer tests. There was a psych eval. There was a panel interview. There was an interview with the chief pilot. And I mean, they stuck you in the actual simulator. And most of us had never seen glass or tapes at that time, you know?
Yeah.
And now today, and all of us had like 3,500, 4,000 hours, because before you got to that point of being interviewed by a regional, you had already gone out and flown single pilot freight in the middle of the night, or flown checks, or flown aerial survey. You'd done all these knickknack jobs to get that much time to be able to that. Now, fast forward to today, it's 1,500 hours. You're in. Actually, you can start interviewing at 1,450, and there's 200 jobs, or there's 100 jobs that month for the 20 guys in line to get them. So people are showing up at interviews that forgot to wear a belt with their suit, or, you know, I mean, I left my tie at home, and they're still getting hired. I mean, it's
a different world.
So it's so comical to me. There is no greater time in the history of man since the Wright brothers first flew to become a professional pilot.
Yeah, a little perspective in numbers. The peak of the early 2000s hiring boom, pre-Great Recession, I think it was about 2,500 airline pilots got hired a year. And in the last couple of years, it's been over 10,000. And you can pick your stats, but it's absolutely a different league. So let's say I take your advice. I'm in. I want to learn to fly. Maybe even one of these mid-career change people, which we're seeing more of. Let's walk through the three main steps. So I got to do some flight training. I got to build some time. Then I have to get hired. So let's start with the flight training. And we could spend obviously a whole episode on this. But at a high level, a question I hear a lot is, should I go to my local flight school? Do I go to one of these national chains or academies? Do I need to go to university and get a 4-year degree in aviation? What's your advice for somebody who's evaluating which school to check out first?
Well, at the end of the day, you're going to get the same certificates and ratings. No matter what you do. But Mike and I's advice and all of our stuff that we're talking about, any of our whatever platforms or whatever we're speaking on, we're always pushing the accelerated training. The faster you go, the obviously the less time it's going to take, but you're also going to save money. You can correlate it to trying to learn a foreign language. If you were just trying to learn Spanish for an hour and a half to 2 hours once per week versus showing up at the airport 8 hours a day for 2 weeks straight, who's gonna figure out Spanish, you know, in a better way or faster even.
Right.
But so the accelerated flight schools are the way to go. And part of Mike and I's thing that we do is we kind of help people teach their mom and pop flight school how to do that, how to make it into an accelerated training program. The ATP, you know, ATP is a big name, American Flyers. They got some great programs. You know, some of the advantages of going with the big, we call them big box schools versus the mom and pop, is they're hooked up with all these financing companies. They're also with some of the airlines and the, you know, actually we interviewed a guy that's going to ATP, and Mike, what airline was it? One of the regionals were out there paying these guys if they agreed to come work.
Oh, it's crazy. Yeah. It was Frontier Airlines. So we got an interview on our channel with a guy named Jamal that had his own YouTube channel. That's how we met him. And just an extraordinary story. But he was an airport manager in Texas and hated the job, Midland, Texas, I think. And he decided, hey, you know, I want to be a pilot. So he sold everything he owned, financed everything, went to ATP, got his all his ratings in 7 months. And this guy, he's telling us that Frontier Airlines will interview you once you graduate from the course. They'll guarantee you a job once you hit 1500 hours. So you accept a conditional job offer. They'll pay you $1,000 a month stipend on top of your flight instructor pay. So you're not even working there yet. You're working as a flight instructor wherever, building time. They give you $1,000 an hour. Once a month, once you reach the hour requirements that Frontier requires, you're instantly hired, and then you get a $50,000 sign-on bonus to wipe out over half of your debt. I mean, it's crazy. And then you think about another reason we say go as fast as possible. Not only does that save you money in training, but it gets you on this wave of hiring sooner. And, you know, there's going to be a finite retirement date if you're at the airlines, whether it's 65 or they extend it, who knows. But, you know, you're going to get 1 to 2, maybe 3 more top earning years before you retire if you start sooner rather than later. So that alone could make you, you know, adjusted for inflation, $500,000 a year richer by just jumping in as quickly as you can. And none of the airlines right now are requiring 4-year degrees, and many people are getting hired without them now. So it's not what your parents want you to hear. You know, they'll say, hey, you need to get a 4-year degree to fall back on, which is excellent advice. You know, it's a very conservative mindset. But when you're really looking at this pragmatically, the thing you should do is just jump into it as fast as you can and get on somewhere as fast as you can and start flying and making money.
So time building is a key part of that. If I've gone to one of these schools and I've got my ratings, there I am at 250 hours, maybe a commercial certificate, maybe I get a flight instructor. Are there any tips you offer there for getting to 1500? Does it matter if I have turbine time? Does it matter if I have multi-time? What should I do to close that gap?
Yeah, when Mike and I came up, you know, it was all about the multi-time. That was everybody's big hang up to get on with their first commuter job. Not a regional, it was a commuter. You would use some Beach 1900, you know, a little turboprop thing.
Yeah.
And it was all about multi-engine time. You needed at least 500 multi. So where do you find that? Usually flying checks in a Baron, or, you know, trying to sit right seat with somebody, or just outright pay for it, which is the most expensive type of time to buy. So today that's all changed with the 1500 hour rule. Now basically all you need is a multi-engine rating. So guys are getting hired with 10 hours of multi-engine time. But to get the time, just like Mike said, is important, and that is one of our specialities that we're always on. We have one of our most popular videos on our podcast is skipping your CFI to go fly a jet. And we get really into detail with that, of being at the airport and networking with people and getting yourself into the right seat of a jet, and even a jet that has a required co-pilot, which is what you really want, getting that SIC endorsement, which is way easier than you think. And
interject, a lot of people think that you need 1500 hours to be a corporate pilot. That's not true.
Right. Yeah. As a Part 91, you need a commercial multi-engine and instrument rating. So you could be there right at 250 hours and be sitting right seat legally beside Mike or I, and flying around in a big jet. And getting that time quickly is important, like Mike just pointed out, with the whole skip in college. And, you know, for every year you wait, you got to think about those big bucks on the back end of your career, which are, that's, you know, something else I should mention. You know, when we came up, you know, when it was 3,500 hours, 4,000 hours before you got to the regional, now guys are getting hired their early 20s with 1500 hours. People didn't make it to the majors. Not everybody made it to the majors, but if you did, it wasn't till your mid 40s back then. Now people are getting at the majors late 20s. So the pay
early
scale,
20s in some cases.
Yeah. The pay scales are even having to be rewritten. I mean, every major pay scale, United, American, Delta, UPS, FedEx, they're all 10 or 12 year pay scales. So as the new contracts come out, they're lengthening those to catch up with the times. But it is so, you got to think, you go to college and spend 4 years there, or you get wrapped up with the wrong company and spend 2 years messing around with Joe Blow company in this city and flying something, whatever, you know, those 2 years times $450,000 a year on the back end of your career, that'll bring a tear to your eye.
Yeah. And Sean can probably, he has firsthand experience with this, but this large airline hiring is sucking pilots out of the corporate world like a vacuum cleaner. So, overtime airline pilots make more money than corporate pilots. So you're going to have some natural progression, you know, from those jobs to airline jobs. So it's really causing a strain for first officers. And you think it's hard to find first officer for regional jets. First officers on corporate airplanes are very difficult also. So, you know, Sean, what's the lowest time? Sean works for a huge company, a very large aircraft management company that, you know, what's the lowest time FOs that you've been flying?
We have a kind of a niche thing we discovered of stealing talented flight instructors away from schools. And we got guys that come out with us with 300 hours. And the good ones we keep around and we send them to school and type them in the airplanes. We got guys that are still with us today. Some of our best pilots came to us with 300 hours and, have been there flying right seat. And now they're the captain. We got a guy, captain on a Challenger 300 right now that has been with us for a few years, started off with 300 hours in the right seat. Wow. And now he's on a Challenger 300, which is the plane Mike flies. And it's, one of the best corporate jets ever built.
So that brings up the question then, if it's really about speed and get those 1500 hours and don't waste time, let's go to that third step I brought up of getting hired. Mm-hmm. Do I need to make myself an attractive candidate? Do I need to try to stand out or do I just need to hit those minimum hours? What do I need to do to actually get ready to go get hired?
Well, when you were asking that question, one of the things that popped in my head was, back when we were coming up, Mike and I, there was always these crazy things like, oh, you got to put your resume on a different color piece of paper.
Right, paper.
It needs to be this thickness or it has to be linen paper, like actual, there was all this stuff or doing something silly in the interview so they remember you. At the airline level, I'm probably simplifying it and dumbing it down a little bit, but really, you're going into that regional interview. You got to really try to not get hired. I think you got, but at the corporate level, it's a completely different thing. I mean,
yeah. That's personality. I do have a funny story, John, about that. So, in the year 2000, I have a good friend. I won't mention his name, but Sean knows him too. He's now a captain at Delta Airlines. He got hired right before 9/11, did the whole gamut, flew checks, then flew for Continental Express and moved to Cleveland in the snow and everything, became a captain. Then he finally gets the interview at Delta Airlines and he's so nervous, man, and he has, and this is a legit photo, when he was like 5 years old, his dad took him to the Greater Cincinnati International Airport, went to the observation area, which I'm sure you guys have been to, off of Mineola Pike. There's some picnic tables. You can watch the planes pick up, and his dad took a photo of him standing on the picnic table, and there's a Delta Airlines jumbo jet taxiing out, and he's saluting it like the John F. Kennedy Jr. at the funeral of his father. I mean, it looks so perfect, and it's all old and everything. And he gets this thing out, and he shows. He's like, "This is how I got hired." He shows it to me, and he said, he's in the interview, and he's saying the same bullshit. They say, "Why Delta?" He's like, "Well, I grew up in Cincinnati, and I always wanted to be wrong." And they all say that, yeah. And then he whips out that picture, and they're like, "There's no way that's you." So he did a good job there, but you used to have to play those tricks, but now I don't know. So I don't know that you really need to stress about it. You need to do typical interview things, dress appropriately, talk appropriately, mm-hmm. And it's all about being in the right place at the right time. And this is the right time right now, so I wouldn't stress over that. Corporate interviewing, totally different. You know, that's being part of the club. They're worried about how you interact with the passengers. They're worried about how you are going to, you're a corporate pilot, John, what it's going to be like to spend time on the road with these people. And that, there's some different approaches to that. But good question, though.
Yeah, corporate guys, you're almost considered in it. I mean, we have 17 different clients, and some of those clients, I feel like I'm part of their family when I fly them. And, that's what the corporate operators are looking for. It's not just a numbers on a piece of paper on your resume that you're qualified to do the job. It's a different world and networking goes a long way to answer your original question.
Yep.
Guys, let's take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to ask you some more about corporate flying. We are back with Mike Martin and Sean Ritchie, who have lots of aviation experience beyond the world of airlines. And guys, we were just talking about corporate flying, and many pilots dream of pro pilot jobs and they instantly think airline. And that's certainly where the flashy pay packages are. But there is this whole world outside of airlines, and it's charter and it's fractional and corporate aviation. There's flying for government services. There's aeromedical. There's really all kinds of other jobs. So give us some of the pros and cons of, maybe I'm not sure about life as an airline pilot. What are some of the pros and cons of these other options?
Great. Yeah, I love this question, John, because I'm a career corporate pilot and know a lot of airline pilots, a lot of great friends that are airline pilots, and I feel like I got a pretty good handle on it. You know, I have no interest in changing over. And, you know, at my experience level in this game with my connections, it would be really, really easy to do. But, the thing about corporate is every job is different. You know, you can look at airline jobs, especially major airline jobs, and whether you're at Delta, American, United, there's small differences, but really they're the same job. The pay's big. It's the same type of thing. Corporate, everything's different. You could be working for a small individual family all the way up to a very large department like Walmart, where they have, you know, 50 airplanes and hundreds of, you know, 100 plus pilots or something like that. So to put it under one cloth is really, really hard to do. But some things that I've experienced with several different corporate operators that I could say that I really like are, number one, the actual volume of flying you do is way less. There's many corporate pilots that fly as many hours annually that an airline pilot does in 1 month. I mean, there's you know, the typical corporate pilot, I'd say 120 hours is a low end, and then maybe 300 hours is a high end for a corporate pilot to fly. So just the sheer volume of flying is remarkably less than an airline pilot. Now, what does that mean? Does that mean you work less? Well, probably, but it does, but you could be gone, you know, a lot of nights. You could fly somewhere for 4 days and, you know, it took 2 hours to get there and then an hour and a half to get back, and you were gone 4 days. So you're still gone the same amount as an airline pilot. But the key thing is, and these are just generalizations, you have way more free time both on the road and at home than you do on an airline pilot. So that gives Sean and I the advantages to do other things. Like, I'm not sure if we were both airline pilots, we could have created the Pro Pilot Playbook and spent all this time on these podcasts and everything. Half the time when you watch our videos, I mean, we have, you know, almost 100 of them, you know, he's somewhere and I'm in a hotel room or something, because we're just doing nothing, right? We're sitting out there. I love that aspect of it. That's probably one of my favorite. The second thing is you really, truly get to enjoy these places you go. So when you work for these people that own these 100, you know, $10 million, $50 million airplanes. I mean, where are they taking them? Well, they do take them to a lot of business places, but they take them to a lot of really, really nice places also.
Guess some of them are beach people. Some of them are mountain people. That's the way I sometimes distinguish them. You know, one client's taking me skiing in Steamboat and I'll airline my family out. The next client, you know, next week I'm going down to Miami. We're going to do some beach time. Or I just got back from Disney World, actually. Spring break, accidentally was there, brought the family down. You know, we get to do, and usually end up with a rental car at these corporate operators. You'll never see that at the airlines. It's a boom, 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 back and forth the hotel and the airport shuttle, and the schedules, you know, can geniusly designed to only give you 8.5 hours a night, you know, so there's no funny business in a bar or something like that. So different world in the corporate aspect. And I totally interrupted you there, Mike.
No, that's fine. You're taking it away.
I actually thought you were winding down. One of those real quick though, John, some of those jobs you mentioned, like the air ambulance and, you know, some smaller mom and pop charter companies, they would be considered more of a rung in the ladder to get to the high end corporate job or to the airline job. Not necessarily, you know, what somebody, you know, I want to be an air ambulance pilot. Maybe not. You know, I could see somebody saying, I want to be a air firefighter, you know, out west, you know, because that's cool stuff, flying low level, dropping water. I could see that. But is that a high paying job as a pilot? Probably not. But right. It's cool.
But if you want to fly for a Fortune 500 company, that's a real career, you know.
Yeah. Right.
And so briefly, if I'm going down that path, as you alluded to earlier, this is where it's not just a matter of get 1500 hours and get hired. It's more about networking, personal connections, who you are as a person, in addition to the flying. So what are some tips for getting on that first rung of the ladder and making a connection? If I think maybe I do want to go the corporate or the charter or even the fractional route.
That's a great question.
Yeah, great question. I'll throw a couple out, Sean. One of our biggest ones that we love is be at the airport, right? You have to be. Why do bank robbers rob banks? You got to go where the money's at, right? So you need to be at these airports, and you need to make yourself seen and known at these airports. And it's actually much easier than you think. Walking around the hangar, talking to people, meeting the people. If you're coming up and you're, you know, in your teens or 20s, just getting started, one of the biggest things you can do is get a job at the airport. You know, I know Sporty's has lots of jobs there. You can get a job at these FBOs, fueling planes. That's putting you in direct contact with these operators every day. People in corporate aviation like to hire people they know. That's a really great tip that we give people.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing is, when you do get your first job, no matter how much you think you may hate it, sitting right seat in a King Air 90, you are now in that corporate world, and all your actions and behaviors and the way you treat people are going to come back around, because this world is small. And I've seen guys burn bridges as they leave a job, and it comes back to haunt them, because you're going to run into these faces again. And, you know, the other thing that happens is, when you're that right seater in the King Air out there, you know, somebody else is going to need a fill-in someday. I need a co-pilot. Hey, who's that kid that's flying for you in the King Air? Oh, well, that's Mike. He's awesome. Call him. We're not flying. Call him. And next thing you know, Mike's sitting in the Citation now. And now that guy gets a call from, oh, you should call, what's his, Mike over here. That's how you move up. And that's how you end up flying for a Procter & Gamble or something like that.
Now, it's a small world, aviation, especially business aviation. Great advice that, take care of whatever job you're doing, do it the best you can. And that's usually the best way to find your next one. Mm-hmm. Guys, we always like to end this podcast with a lightning round. We call it Ready to Copy. So I'm going to throw out a bunch of questions on a wide range of topics, and you guys fire back with your quick answer. Are you both ready to copy?
We're ready.
Ready to copy.
I'll act like I'm Teterboro clearance on a Friday afternoon here. What was the hardest check ride you had to pass? Either an early one, a type rating, something else?
CFI.
I would say Lear 35 initial type rating for the jet at CAE Dallas.
Related to that, I sometimes hear the advice, you should go pay for a type rating, that'll make you a more attractive candidate to be hired. Is that good advice or bad advice?
That's a loser.
Bad advice.
And why is that?
We did a whole podcast on it, actually.
Because you're putting your eggs in the, you know, it's to game the system that particular operator is going to have the job you want, is going to have the particular plane that you want. It's just too risky.
And you got to look at it like this too. Let's say you're the guy that only has 1200, 1500 hours, but money isn't a factor for you, and you just go out and buy a type rating. You know, that employer looking at you with no time, basically, and now you've got this $40,000 type rating that showed up on your resume. That just looks odd to me if I'm the guy interviewing you. I mean, that's just weird. That's not normal, you know? And it's already built into most of these, you know, any company you'd want to work for, you don't want to work for them if they're hiring you just because you have a type rating. That's built into a real company's program to pay to train you. So, yeah.
What is something you should never do at an airline interview?
Use profanity.
Yeah, I agree. I don't know. That's a good one. But you should never not leave there without asking some questions. I mean, when they say, do you have any questions for us? They mean, what are your questions for us?
Right. And not wear a suit, be underdressed, I would say would be bad too.
Yeah.
Describe a great co-pilot in 10 words or less. You guys have both flown with lots of co-pilots, and unlike the airline world, corporate world can be different, right? What's a great co-pilot to you?
Easy to adapt. So I've had the advice early on, and it really worked out, is you need to be a chameleon. You need to know whatever the captain, read the captain. If he's in the cars, you're in the cars. If he's in the GA airplanes, you're in the GA airplanes. If he wants to talk politics, that could be a tough one depending on where you are on the side of the fence. But try to relate to that person as best as you can.
I'm going to say the same thing that I think is how you tell a good pilot from a bad pilot in general. And that is the ability to distinguish what's important from what's not important.
Excellent advice. Excellent advice for life too.
Yeah.
All right. You guys have both logged a lot of time in a lot of different corporate jets. So which one is your favorite?
I don't know. You know, if it was last year, I would say the Lear 31, but recently I just got typed in the CJ4. One of my guys bought a brand new CJ4 Gen 2, and this thing is legit. Look it up. It is the most powerful business jet, pound for pound, in production right now, and this thing is a rocket ship. I mean, I thought that those Lears were powerful. This thing is way overpowered for this little thing, and it can stay in the air for like 6 hours. You pretty in a light jet, you put nine passengers in the back, so 11 total. External serviceable lab. You can almost go coast to coast in this thing. It's like a super light. They should call, you know, they should make a new class for this thing. But yeah, I'm going CJ4.
Awesome. Well, my favorite to fly regularly is the platform I'm on now, the Challenger 300, just because of the size and the beauty of the airplane. But the one that's closest to my heart is, I already mentioned it, my very first type rating in a jet was in a 1984 Lear 35. And it's such an iconic airplane. It has those fuel tanks that look like missiles on it. It was really, it flew, it handled very well, but it was pretty difficult to fly just because it's fast and it had old avionics on it. But I'm very proud that I flew that. There's one in the Dayton Air Force Museum. It's the military version of it that I got to show my kids. But I always tell people that if I ever hit the lotto, I'm going to buy a big farm, and then I'm going to buy an old 35 and have it up on a pedestal, you know, when you pull in the driveway in a turn, because I love how they look every day. Yeah.
That sounds like a reasonable plan for a pilot. All right, let's keep the favorites going. What's your favorite GA airport in the U.S.? You guys have no doubt been to many, many different ones. Which one do you like to see show up on the trip sheet?
This is going to sound odd, but I kind of like Telluride just because it's I love taking the, I call them kids, the 300-hour guys in there. Because when you're coming in to Telluride, I mean, it literally looks like they just chopped the top off a mountain, which they pretty much did, and laid some pavement. It looks like you shouldn't be putting an airplane down where you're putting it down. I mean, it's the highest mountain, or highest mountain, highest airport in the CONUS, in the continental United States, I believe. So, yeah.
Mine is JAC, Jackson Hole, Wyoming. You go in there on a clear day for the first time, and you get on that ramp. Only airport in the country that's inside a national park. And although the Grand Tetons aren't the tallest mountains, they are the tallest by ascent. In other words, the sea level elevation versus, you know, the baseline of the mountain. When you get off that ramp and you out there on the ramp, crack open the door, smell that mountain air, you feel like a god. I love it.
All right, let's turn it around and talk about your least favorite airport, and why is it Teterboro?
What is it Teterboro you speak of? Sounds familiar.
Yeah. I don't care for Chicago Midway either. I think they're trying to do too much with that airport. You know, yeah, I'll keep my comments to myself, but I don't like that one. What else don't you like, Sean?
Mine's BLM, which is Monmouth Belmar. Executive in New Jersey.
Belmar,
this
New Jersey,
thing,
yes.
Yeah, Belmar. It's the little town, but Monmouth Executive is technically the name of the airport. It's it's like they made a gravel pit into an airport, and it's in this kind of a well-to-do community, and the neighbors don't want the airport there. So the fixing up the airport keeps getting voted down. So the lighting always sucks, and there's holes in the runway, and it's just horrible. And then the approach control trying to get out of there. And, but there's constantly all this heavy iron, golf streams and Falcons and all this traffic in and out of there. And nobody wants to fix the airport.
John, do you know why they call New Jersey the Garden State? Because you're always guarding your wallet and guarding your watch.
Well, as George Carlin once said, what are they growing, smokestacks? All right, I'm ready for the hate mail from our New Jersey listeners.
No, I promise. There's some very nice places in New Jersey.
Love you, New Jersey.
It's just a joke.
So let's turn it around and talk about passengers. What makes for a great passenger? They're paying, that's what counts, but you all have your favorites and your least favorite. What makes for a really pleasant passenger on a corporate jet?
When they say, Sean, we know Easter's coming up. Go ahead and take the jet home. Don't mess with the airlines. That's my favorite.
Yes. You do get some, when I flew charter, you do get some very nice tips from some very nice people. Anytime a customer is tipping you, that's really good. And they're usually, you know, big tips when it's for a pilot. So that's all good. I'll kind of spin that question a little bit, but I will say this. I had a perception of, and I flew for high-end charter companies and flew some of the wealthiest people in the world and celebrities and everything. I had a perception before I did this piece is that rich people are miserable. You know, you hear that a lot. They don't get along with their wives and their families, and they're fighting, and money doesn't buy happiness and all that. I actually think after years of doing this, that's actually a coping mechanism that us poor people sell. and you'll find that 99% of corporate passengers are actually very happy. They appear very happy, and they're very pleasant to deal with.
Right. Yeah, I agree.
You're telling on yourself.
Some comedian says something like, you know, what do you mean money doesn't buy happiness? Money buys a jet ski. Have you ever seen anybody not smiling on a jet ski?
That's great.
All right, Mike, as I mentioned in the open, you and I 25 years ago spent some hot afternoons in the skies over Southwest Ohio. So could you do a lazy eight right now to ACS standards if your life depended on it?
Oh, my God. Probably not, to be honest with you, John. I'd love to. You know, I have twin boys now. They're both 17, and Sean's going through this too. He has young boys. Sean's just bought an airplane, actually, and I'm really thinking of getting back into GA flying. Like Sean always says, you spend your time in little planes to get to the big plane so you can afford a little plane again. So I'm thinking about jumping back in, and I would love to get back. Maybe you could teach me, Matt, John. Maybe.
Yeah, I make no promises. All right, guys, our last question is always the same on pilot's discretion. You have one final flight, and we want to know, what are you flying and where are you going?
You go first, Sean.
As in, what airplane am I flying? Yeah. Oh, gosh. Does it have to be something I've actually flown before?
Absolutely not. You can pick an SR-71 if you want.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Yeah. Yeah, it's probably going to be an F-14 Tomcat, and I'm heading to Costa Rica, San Jose.
I'm going to go with the Global 7500, and I'd have to go somewhere warm also, probably St. Martin.
Both sound fun to me. Mike and Sean, thanks for being on the podcast.
Yeah, thank you for having us. This was awesome.
Great time.
Thanks for listening to Pilot's Discretion, brought to you by Sporties, training and equipping pilots worldwide for over 60 years. For more episodes and today's show links, visit sporties.com/podcast. I'm John Zimmerman. We'll see you next time on Pilot's Discretion.